Welcome to the EI Podcast. I'm Paul Lay, Senior Editor at Engelsberg Ideas. And our guest today, I'm delighted to say, is Mark David Baer, who is Professor of International History and Head of Department at the London School of Economics. Now, Professor Baer wrote a brilliant and somewhat bloody history of the Ottomans called The Ottomans, Khans, Caesars and Caliphs, and it was received with widespread, considerable acclaim, shortlisted for the Wolfson History Prize as well, and it is a tremendous read. But now he's produced a new, and I think very timely, book called Children of Abraham, The Story of Jewish-Muslim Relations. So welcome, Professor Baer.
Thank you for having me.
The book's title sets us up nicely, I think, Children of Abraham, which refers, of course, to the shared inheritance of Judaism, of Christianity, and of course, Islam. And I just wondered what you were trying to do with the book. What's missing from books for the general reader? And I presume this book is aimed at the general reader very much. So what's missing from the existing histories of Jewish-Muslim relations?
Well, if you go into any bookstore in London, you'll find a number of books about Israel and Palestine. And that seems to be all that anyone has to say about Jewish-Muslim relations. I've been thinking about this topic for 25, 30 years, even longer, ever since I was an undergraduate. And I've lived in the Middle East. I've spent a lot of time doing research and publishing about Ottoman Empire and Jewish-Muslim relations in that empire. But when the 7th of October happened, and followed by Israel's launching of this cataclysmic destruction of Gaza, I decided I wanted to think about the long history of Muslim-Jewish relations.
So you're panning out.
To go back to the very beginning, to look at 1,415 years of interactions between these two people. And so I do begin in biblical times, and I look at the story of Abraham, how Muslims and Jews claim descent even, but also certainly spiritual descent in the Christian case. But for Muslims and Jews, it's very, very real. Muslims and Jews are brothers, you can say, if we look at the Bible and the Quran.
So there's a shared genealogy.
There's a shared, literally a shared genealogy. There's a family connection, and there's a closeness that is missing with Christians. Again, for Christians, it's a spiritual connection. But for Muslims and Jews, it's an actual family connection. And I wanted to recapture that and trace that over the entire time span around the Mediterranean, whether Jews lived under Muslim rule or Muslims lived under Jewish rule.
So can you expand on that a little bit and take us back to those roots so that we can see that shared moment that Jews and Muslims have?
Going back to Abraham or going back to the first Muslims?
Well, I suppose it would inevitably go back to the first Muslims, I suppose.
So if we go back to the late 500s, the early 600s, when Muhammad emerges as a preacher in Mecca, he has to take flight with his followers. And they go to a city which today we know as Medina, which was then called Yathrib. And when Muhammad and his beleaguered followers, the believers as they call themselves at the time, they show up in Yathrib, there are five Jewish tribes there, along with pagans. And three of those Jewish tribes are powerful, they're wealthy, they have castles, they have arms, their women dress in silk brocade, and Muhammad needs them, he needs their help. And what those powerful Jewish tribes offer at the beginning is an alliance. So at the very beginning of Islamic history, there's an alliance between the believers who will become the Muslims and the Jews. These are Arabic-speaking Jews, Arabic-speaking believers, and they are going to form what they call an ummah. So it's a community that consists of Muslims and Jews. Now today, when Muslims use the word ummah, they mean Muslims, Muslims exclusively, whether here in London or around the world, Muslims connected, brothers and sisters. But when Muslims and Jews were allies, they formed the same community. And this is astounding when we think about it.
And how does looking at these Jewish Muslim through, I suppose you do it through a comparative lens rather than, and as you pointed out, so much of it is this obsession, understandably, with Palestine and Israel. It's very 20th and 21st century the focus is. I mean, this is a problem with history in a wider sense, I think, as an early modernist. But there you go. But to think in that way instead of separate national or religious boxes, does it change the way we understand the history of, first of all, the Middle East and then Europe?
It does, because again, if we look at this very beginning, it wasn't clear where the boundary lay between believers and Jews. So the very first believers, the followers of Muhammad, prayed toward Jerusalem. They also parted their hair in a certain way, dressed in a certain way. They talked about using the shofar, the ram's horn, to call the faithful to prayer. There are a million ways where they appeared as if they might be Jews. And in fact, Jews were confused. These Arab Jews said, well, if you believe in all the previous prophets, and if you believe that the Torah, the Old Testament, is the word of God, then are you Jews? So, of course, the difference was Muhammad claimed that he was a prophet and that God had spoken to the Jews. The Jews had gotten the message wrong. And then God had come again to the Christians. And again, they had gotten the message wrong. So now for the third time, this was the third call that God was speaking to people, speaking through the angel Gabriel, who was the one who told Mary that she would give birth to the Messiah, Christ. Speaking through Gabriel, God gave the recitation, the Quran, to Muhammad. So this was the final call, the last chance for people to return to the true monotheistic religion. This was the claim. And Muhammad made connections to all the previous prophets. So in the famous night journey that we read about, Muhammad traveled from Arabia to Jerusalem, and he goes to the spot of where the Jewish temple had been. And he goes to heaven, and he meets all the previous prophets, and all the prophets declare that he, in fact, is one of them. So this was the message that Muslims were, that the Muhammad and the believers were giving to Jews and Christians and pagans in Arabia. So relations were close at the beginning. They were allies at the beginning. But over time, there was a falling out between Muhammad and these three powerful tribes, to the extent that there were battles, there were sieges of their castles. The first two tribes were expelled. The final tribe was, well, destroyed. All the men were executed. The women and children were sold into slavery. And Muhammad ended up marrying two of these Jewish women from these different tribes. The point is that relations began incredibly close. Relations continued to be intimate, but there was this falling out that ended in violence. And this brings us up to today. So when we look back at the past, there are those who will look back at that first Ummah and say, look, Muslims and Jews, they are brothers. They got along together. They were allies. Let's think about that. And let's work towards those kind of relations today. But then there's other people who say, now, wait a minute. Muhammad personally executed hundreds of Jewish men in the marketplace of Medina. And that's the course that Islamic history has taken. Jews and Muslims have always been at loggerheads. And we see that again today with Hamas and Israel fighting. So we look at history. We look at what happened. And people pick and choose from the facts, and they build their myths of relations.
And they create a narrative from that that suits their purposes, presumably.
You had asked about the comparative element, Jews living under Muslim rule with Jews living under Christian rule.
Yeah, because you're quite interesting about that. There seems to be these two myths that go together. And I think about this quite a lot when you mentioned 7th of October, but there was a great deal of renewed interest in Islam after 9/11, of course, in profoundly important historical event. And some people would argue the history of Jews and Muslims is one of great cohesion and very, very constructive relationship. Others would argue that, you know, it's just endless opposition and enmity. And yet you offer a much more complex picture of those relationships over 1,500 or so years.
Because we see these relations going up and down. And so there's in the Palestinian and also Sephardic Jewish proverb, there's days of honey and days of onion. So sometimes because of this shared culture, speaking the same language, being from the same homelands, sharing the same food, being pure monotheist and distinguishing themselves from Christians, who Jews and Muslims don't see as true monotheists. Leave that to the side. But so there's this closeness, this intimacy, but this very intimacy and closeness also leads to jealousy, which can then be turned into hatred, which can be turned into violence. So we see, for example, over time, we see Jews rising in pre-modern times in Muslim-ruled societies to the top of society. So in theory, Jews, like Christians in Muslim-ruled pre-modern societies, are not supposed to bear arms. They're not supposed to ride horses. They're not supposed to build new synagogues or churches. They're not supposed to rule or have any power over Muslims. But repeatedly, in pre-modern Muslim kingdoms, this was happening. You had Jews who would serve as viziers, as prime ministers, inspect the troops of Andalusia, a Spanish Muslim sultan, before they go into battle to fight against another Muslim kingdom. And these Jews were on horseback. There were Jews with arms. Also the case was, this was also the case in the Ottoman Empire, also in Morocco. So despite these sort of rules, these rules were always violated. These norms were violated. And Jews were powerful, some the elite, and they're on intimate terms with Muslim rulers. And this sort of situation could lead to accusations of poisoning, which could then lead to, again, violence, as we see in Granada in 1066, when the Jews of the town are massacred. But it's precisely because Jewish elite man has the king, the sultan, over for dinner because they're so close. It's only because they're so close that he could be accused of poisoning him. So personal differences, so there would be jealous courtiers who would not be assigned a post, could then say, well, actually, I didn't get the post. The post was given to a Jew, and this is not right. This, the hierarchy of society is supposed to be Muslims on top, Jews and Christians are second-class subjects. And so for most of pre-modern Islamic history, this pact of protection worked, which is to say, as long as Jews and Christians paid a tax and generally appeared to be humble with some restrictions on their lives, they were safe, their lives, their property, and they were able to have a place in society, an economic place in society, and so on, that was impossible in contemporary Christian Europe.
Can we talk of a golden age in any sense of Muslim-Jewish relations? I mean, we always talk about the Zirids of Granada, for example, as you say, in the 11th century. They rely on Jewish officials. You've mentioned Morocco, the Alawites, who relied on Jewish merchants up to the 18th century, I think. Two questions, really. What do they offer one another? I mean, I presume that the Muslim rulers offer some form of protection, but what is it that the Jews are offering? And then try and explore that difference between the way in which Jews relate to Muslims as opposed to the way they relate to Christians. What are the fundamental differences there?
Well, what the Jews get in this bargain is safety, the ability to practice the religion. So Jews are forcibly converted to Catholicism in medieval Spain and Portugal. They flee to Morocco, where they return to Judaism. Most Jews who were forcibly converted in Spain and Portugal would end up, over 100,000, we think, in the Ottoman Empire, where again, they can return to Judaism. And again, despite the pact, which says they can't build new synagogues, they're building new synagogues. They're rising to power. So what they gain is the ability to practice their religion, safety and surety, but also taking part in this universal culture. So for 1,000 years, most Jews live under Muslim rule, and they live in some of the wealthiest, most economically advanced, technologically advanced, intellectually exciting societies. So Jews gain from that. But again, because Jews switch to Arabic, most Jews in the lands that the Arabs conquered and converted to Arabic-speaking regions, the Jews also dropped Aramaic. They kept Hebrew, obviously, as their learned language, the language of prayer, but they switched to Arabic. And speaking Arabic meant that it wasn't only that they could communicate in the market and they made business partnerships and would trust each other, trust Muslims in these business partnerships, setting sail from Tunisia, going all the way to India, right, with their Muslim partners. But that wasn't it only. Intellectuals were able to engage and learn, absorb all of the ancient learning that had been translated into Arabic, partly through, well, Arabic-speaking Jewish scholars. They were able to engage in all the greatest learning in history, really, from the Western world. And then some of the greatest Jewish books of philosophy, but also of linguistics and study of the Torah and study of Judaism were written in Arabic. So Jews gain in all these different ways. Muslims gain the allegiance of a loyal ally. And again and again and again in history, pre-modern, modern times, again, the Jew is the ally of the Muslim. You mentioned the Moroccan Sultan. The Moroccan Sultan creates this position called the Tujar Sultan, which is also called the Sultan's Jew in colloquial speak, where the Moroccan Sultan entrusts Jewish merchants to take his most valuable goods and become his official trader here in London in the 17th and 18th century. Later on, when he sends some Muslim merchants as well to London, those Muslim merchants live with the Jews in London, precisely because they share the same dietary restrictions, they share the same hygienic habits, they are really brothers in culture and from the same homeland. And some of these Muslims then also, when the British authorities ask them to register, keep a track of them, they ask them for their address. We've looked at the archival documents, and their address, they write down the Bevismark Synagogue, right? So
the Bevismark Synagogue being the oldest extant synagogue,
the Sephardic synagogue and the only synagogue in the city of London, all of whose rabbis were in the beginning were Moroccan and so on. So there's these connections. So Jews and Muslims are gaining. Muslims also are, they have this, again, this loyal group of people who rely on them and who, again, help them not only expand their intellectual horizons, but also through these merchants. Again, I mentioned the India trade, the trade with England for hundreds and hundreds of years.
Is there an intelligence aspect to this as well through this Jewish network that's global?
Oh, absolutely. Jews will serve as spies, for example, for the Ottoman Empire.
Yeah.
And Jews also know these languages. So Jews, if they come from, you know, from Portugal and Spain, they speak Portuguese, they speak Catalan, let's say.
Well, they're in Amsterdam or somewhere.
That's right. They also speak Dutch.
Yeah.
So, but then in India, of course, they're able to keep an eye on the Portuguese, especially, who are the big rivals of the Ottomans in the 16th century. In places today, the news is all about the Straits of Hormuz. So in the 16th century, it was the Portuguese and the Ottomans battling out for control of the Straits of Hormuz. And the Ottomans used Jewish spies to keep an eye on the other side.
How would you define the relationship? I mean, I've done, you know, I'm a historian of the 17th century, so I've done quite a lot of work on Cromwell's resettlement of Jews, and that's going back to Bevismark's later, which is one of those earliest manifestations of the return of Jews to England. There's a spiritual element to the reason why Jews are resettled in England, but there's also a material one.
Oh, there's a lot of opposition, though.
There's lots of opposition, yes. I mean, it's very much put through on the kind of strongman element to that. But I wondered the difference there between the religious ideas and theology versus these more material factors, the tension that's there, you know, empire, capitalism, you know, Jews were renowned as bankers, as merchants. And I wonder how those tensions changed over time, if they did change over time.
And tensions where?
Between the theological elements, where obviously there was a difference between Judaism and Islam, despite their shared inheritance, and that of the material benefits that Jews offered.
There's not too much of a theological contestation between Judaism and Islam as there is, of course, between Christianity and Judaism, because there's 100 different reasons, obviously. But you don't see as much as this theological debate or concerns.
And why is that?
Again, because Islam, like Judaism, are both true monotheist religions that focus on the one true God. Now, the original version of this book was 2.5 times as long, and I had a lot of Arabic and a lot of Hebrew in there in parentheses that were taken out, obviously, so as not to confuse the reader. But so much of Judaism and Islam, to a certain extent, are not objectionable to someone on the other side. So again, I begin the book, I talk about the course I teach here at the LSE. It's got a very long title, History of Jewish-Muslim Relations, again, from the time of Muhammad all the way till the present day in London. And it's a 20-week, it's a year-long course. Yeah. And the very first day, again, I take out these note cards and I write different things on them. I put down different prayers from Islam and Judaism. And I ask students, okay, which religion is, of course, they're in English, which religion is this? And the students often are confused because until you mention Muhammad, obviously, as the messenger of God, it's just about one God. So I'll give you another example of this. So in the book, in one chapter, I talk about the medieval Jewish Khazar Turkish kingdom. And not too long ago, a coin was found. And this coin looks like an Abbasid, so early Islamic caliphal coin, because it says in Arabic, it says, there is no God but God. So that's how it begins. And then it says, and Moses is the prophet of God instead of Muhammad. So again, this is the thing. So either Jews or Muslims could say, you know, there's no God but God. That's the Islamic formulation. But I'm Jewish. I could say there's no God but God, and that doesn't violate any of my concepts. So this closeness is something I explore in the book, and there's many, many examples.
And Christianity is fundamentally different.
Absolutely.
And can you just point that out for those who are less theologically sophisticated?
You don't have to be sophisticated. It's not a complicated idea at all. But again, Judaism and Islam, Jews and Muslims worship God directly. And there's no mediator between God and humans. Whereas Christians, of course, have this figure of Jesus, who is both man and God. Obviously, Christians differ on the precise nature. And not only that, but also in Islam and Judaism, you don't need a class of priests to intercede either. So any man in Orthodox Judaism, Orthodox Islam, can be the prayer leader, so long as they're, you know, of a certain age and knowledgeable and mentally sound and so on. So you don't need even men to come between man and God. So these are just basic differences.
Yeah. Now, as I mentioned earlier, your work, both your scholarly work and stuff for the general reader is focused on the Ottoman and the post-Ottoman worlds. Obviously, there's the great change with the conquest of Constantinople in 1453. How significant is that an event in Muslim-Jewish relations?
It certainly is. Earlier I mentioned how, you know, 100,000 or so Jews persecuted in Western Europe fled and settled in the Ottoman Empire. And because of this, since that time, it's been almost, I don't know, 600 years, Jews have written ecstatically about Muslims as their savior. And in those days, 15th, 16th, 17th century, they wrote about the Ottoman Sultan in messianic terms, in biblical terms, saying not that Turks are great people, as you know, but the Turks have no agency, but God, working through the Ottomans, used them as the rod of God. That's a phrase from a chronicle. Used Turks as a rod of God to beat their Christian enemies and to save them. But again, we were talking earlier about myths. So this is all true. This is all real. So Jews did take refuge in the Ottoman Empire. They did write ecstatically about the Ottomans. They were saved by the Ottomans. In the empire, the elite rose to positions at court and, again, were very important allies of the Ottomans. This is all true. But now the question is, what do we do today? How do we talk about that? So there's really a very one-sided conversation about this, and people tend not to look at the flip side, which is when relationships worsened. And in fact, in the book, the most horrible scene of violence against a Jewish woman and her son takes place in the Ottoman Empire, not in modern times. And this is important to point out. And I talk about how Muslims in the Ottoman Empire perceive Jews. So Jews perceived Muslims in just, again, ecstatic terms as their saviors and so on. Muslims didn't see things the same way. Muslims continued with earlier pre-modern ideas about Jews being loyal, sure, but potentially dangerous because they might lord it over Muslims. They might get too much power. And if they get too much power, they'll have to be put back in their place. So as a historian, I have to talk about all of this together. And again, this is not what people usually talk about when they talk about the Ottomans. They only talk about the Golden Age aspect, which again, which is an exaggeration based on truce. But if we're going to try to understand the history of Muslim-Jewish relations, we can't just talk about the persecution and the violence. We also can't just talk about when Muslims saved Jews either.
Mm. And the decline of the Ottoman Empire is a long process. How did that affect Jewish-Muslim relations? Did it deteriorate? What were the stresses there? What were the ruptures that took place during that period of decline?
Actually, relations between Jews and Muslims in the Ottoman Empire, on the whole, and this is, the Ottoman Empire was an empire ruled by a Muslim sultan, were better than relations between Muslims and Jews in the modern secular nation state of Turkey. So Jews did not face violence from the regime in the Ottoman Empire. Jews have faced many episodes of persecution in the Turkish Republic in the 1920s, 30s, and 40s especially. So this is, again, this is something that people don't really want to think about because they think that, well, modern times are more tolerant, enlightened, advanced. Secularism is better than theological rule. I'm not making either comparison, but I'm just saying as a historian, you know, Jews didn't face violence until the empire ended and they were faced with a homogenizing, racist, race-based nationalist republic that only had room for people accepted as Turks and had no room for people like Jews.
When you write about that in the book, about the threat of nationalism to relations between Muslim-Jewish relations, and you see the decline of the Ottoman Empire and eventually the fall of the Ottoman Empire, I couldn't help thinking and making a comparison with the Habsburg Empire as well, where you have this incredibly vibrant Jewish culture and community, much of it quite secular. I mean, you think of the great Austro-Hungarian novelist like Joseph Roth or someone, you know, there are great figures there, Stefan Zweig. And so you have a similar cultural flourishing of Jewish ideas, not necessarily explicitly Jewish, but they are Jewish. And I wonder if there is something, this is very unfashionable, to think that's beneficial about empires when it comes to minorities, including Jews.
Well, certainly there's a difference between a cosmopolitan empire, which is made up of hundreds of ethnicities, nationalities, language groups. There's a big difference between that and a nation state like Turkey, say, which only allows one language, Turkish, to be taught in schools and only allows one mode of being, a secular nationalist mode of being in the 1920s, 30s, and 40s that has zero room for any, you know, no tolerance of difference whatsoever. These empires are empires of difference. They function as, again, a multicultural, cosmopolitan, polyglot system. But again, I wouldn't want to be nostalgic about because, again, here we are living in London. We believe in equality. You know, every British citizen, whatever their religion, their race, their gender, what have you, should be treated equally by the state. And this wasn't the case in these empires until the very end. And when, and this is the turning point, when these empires began to treat Muslims and Jews legally the same, then we have a turning point in history. Now, today people talk about these myths because they talk about Israel and Palestine. And there's a lot of people who will say relations were great between Jews and Muslims, but in 1948, you had the imposition of a Jewish state, and that ended good relations between Jews and Muslims. 1948 is the turning point. Well, 1948, of course, was a turning point when, for the first time since that medieval Turkish Jewish kingdom, Jews are ruling over Muslims and ruling the Jewish holy cities of Jerusalem and Hebron for the first time since ancient times. Yes. However, we have to look again at the dissolution of these empires. So I like to talk less about 1948 as the first change in modern times, of course. I like to look at 1798. I would like to look at the French Revolution and the introduction of the idea that Jews are equal in France. Jews are made equal citizens. And this is a profound idea, because then French Jews are going to spread this idea when the French take over in Algeria, in Morocco, Tunisia. And again, in 1798, Napoleon takes Egypt, at least Cairo. And in Egypt, he makes Christians equal to Muslims. Again, they had been second-class subjects. He arms Christians. He appoints Christian governors and administrators. And then when the French then, 30 years later in 1830, take Algeria, there aren't Christians in Algeria. They'll side with Jews. And in 1870, France will make most Algerian Jews French citizens. But most Muslim Algerians, who are the vast majority of the population, are not allowed to become French citizens. So this is really a difference. It's French and British colonialism. The British will then do similar things in Iraq and Egypt after the French. But then the Ottomans themselves, too, will also see the writing on the wall. And in 1856, they'll make Christians, Jews, and Muslims legally equal. They all are eligible to serve in the military together. So, and same thing will happen in Tunisia around the same time, 1858. So it's really this change. This is 100 years before, the century before Israel is created. It's this change where colonialism changes those relations, those legal relations, and where Jews begin to imagine that they don't have to be second-class subjects.
You seem to imply that there's a difference between French and British imperialism, which you might call European imperialism, and Ottoman imperialism. Would that be fair?
That's fair. I mean, I think really, I mean, the French in the earlier period of colonialism and then the British in the later period after the 1880s, the French from, you know, 1790s to the 1830s into the 1870s are making these profound changes that are going to really lead to a kind of rupture between Muslims and Jews. Now, don't get me wrong, because even after the creation of Israel in 1948, into the 1950s, Arabic-speaking Jews in Iraq, in Egypt, in Morocco, Tunisia, Algeria, will still very much be part of society. They will still be in a place like Baghdad. Baghdad, 30% of people in Baghdad were Jews. Jews would lead political parties, especially the Communist Party in some of these countries I mentioned. Jews would also lead trade unions. Jews would be parliamentarians. Jews would be government ministers in all these places, even into the late 1950s. But eventually, the introduction of Israel as a Jewish state will be a profound rupture, and especially after 1967, when Israel conquers Jerusalem and the West Bank of the Jordan River from Jordan. And in the West Bank, you have the holy city of Hebron as well. After this, it's going to be extremely difficult for Jews to remain citizens in most Arabic-speaking countries.
And you see now an absence of both Jews and Christians in places where there were once flourishing communities in the Middle East.
Right. Now, the flip side of that is, of course, Israel is creating a country which is for Jews only. So Israel is also part of the process here of separating Muslims and Jews. So all of these, half of the Israeli population in the beginning is made up of Arabic-speaking Arab Jews, but they're not supposed to speak Arabic anymore. They're not supposed to consider themselves Arab anymore. They're supposed to be consider themselves Israelis, Jews by nation, you could say, and they're supposed to leave the Arabic behind. Arabic-speaking Jews are quite mistreated in those early decades in Israel after its creation. And Israel, of course, is to this day is depopulating Muslim and Christian regions of the land that they control. So Israel also has a role to play in making it impossible to imagine that a Jew could be, say, a citizen of Egypt or Iraq.
Yeah. And that's a legacy of nationalism. And when you look at current debates, I mean, this is where we came in about Israel, Palestine, refugees, Islam in Europe, for example, is a pertinent question, and the very real rise in anti-Semitism. What are some of the historical, the profound historical misunderstandings that you see rising constantly and which you're eager to address or correct?
Well, again, it's up to us to choose which stories we tell. I mean, the subtitle of the book is The Story of Jewish-Muslim Relations. There's actually a lot of different stories. Yeah. We could talk about what's happening today in London in different ways as well. So recently, a Somali Muslim went on a rampage in Gorders Green, which is a Jewish neighborhood. It's where I do my kosher shopping, and wounded two men, but tried to wound another of them. This is a Somali Muslim man. So a lot of people have then extrapolate from that. See, look, you know, and you can imagine different things people have been saying about that. But yes, this is something we have to think about. But at the same time, in another North London neighborhood, a group of Somali Muslims were the first people to show their solidarity and their love and brother and sisterhood with a Jewish congregation that had been subject to an arson attack. And that's precisely because, and this is a historical lesson, that's precisely because those Jews, that Jewish congregation, that synagogue, when that Somali Muslim congregation had its house of worship firebombed, and they needed a place to worship, and they needed a place to congregate, they went to the synagogue. And that synagogue community allowed them for months to pray in their synagogue. So this is the thing. So when Jews and Muslims know each other, when they have relations with each other, then we can see this kind of solidarity when we face common enemies. And this is also the case in history. So going back to Baghdad, so 1941, there were riots in Baghdad, also in Basra, and hundreds of Jews, up to 200 Jews, were killed. Now, at the same time, hundreds of other Jews were saved. And the Jews that were saved from the rampaging mob were those Jews who had Muslim neighbors, Muslim business associates, Muslim friends. And we see the same thing happening throughout history. So that's why I always want to talk about those intimate relations, and I always want to promote friendship and understanding between Muslims and Jews, especially when we face the same common enemies. Now, it may not seem such a big deal to all listeners, but every single year, there are moves to ban circumcision in this country. Now, this is something that Muslims and Jews, this is something we do. But every year, there are people who want to get it. Now, I'm all for regulating it, of course, but to ban it, you know, this is something that this is quite frightening for Muslim Jews. So every year, imams and rabbis get together and they fight against this. Every year, there are attempts to ban kosher and halal slaughter in this country. This is one of the first things that the Nazis did, by the way, was to get rid of kosher slaughter. So every year, imams and rabbis get together and they push back against this, saying, no, this is what we need to carry out our religious lives. So there are these instances when Muslims and Jews, especially the leadership, as in ancient times, earlier times, medieval times, can get together. The problem we face now is not usually the imams and the rabbis, but the congregation. So it's the rest of the people in the synagogue, in the mosque, who may hate Jews or Muslims, or may have fears about them, or may believe in conspiracy theories about them. That's the problem we have, is just your average Muslim or Jew needs to, I think, my belief is, interact with the other group and see what we have in common. Now, we're going to differ. We're going to differ on things such as Palestine, Israel. There will be differences. However, we look for those commonalities as British people here, and I think that's where the solution lies. And again, there are groups, like-minded Jews and Muslims. There's a women's group where, again, they have their differences, their political differences, but as women, Jewish and Muslim, women of faith, they gather, they get together, and they find common cause.
We've talked about British and French imperialism there. I wonder if both have faced the challenges of a multicultural society, France and Britain. They deal with it in very different ways. With France's laicite, it's much more secular. The burqa is banned, for example, face coverings. Britain has historically taken a more tolerant view of that, a much less interventionist view. Is there an approach that you approve of more than the other?
I don't know. I mean, I'm originally from the US, which is more like the UK, which is more live and let live, whereas France, of course, is more has a monocultural approach, saying this is the way to be French, and you have to side with it. I spent many years living in Germany, and Germany is also closer to the French model in many ways. There's less tolerance for difference in a place like Germany. I'm not going to advocate any one particular one. What is needed, really, honestly, living in London, what is needed is it for both sides of the debate over Israel-Palestine, both sides need to see the trauma and the suffering of the other side. But that's not something we get today in London. You'll have people who will only speak about the victims of one group, and then the other side will only speak about the victims of the other group. But to me, and I mentioned this in the book, I mean, a child being killed is a tragedy, no matter the nationality or religion of that child. And so it's only if we have this human view will we be able to get past our political differences today.
And so when our listeners finish reading Children of Abraham, they ask themselves, what should I do differently with the knowledge you've imparted? And what would you suggest in the way that they talk, they vote, they engage with their neighbours? I mean, what would you hope your answer to them would be?
Well, one thing is to turn off your social media and to go talk to your neighbor. Of course, that's easier said than done sometimes. But one thing is to not fall for these myths. You know, the myth that relations were always beautiful, harmonious. Don't fall for that. Also, don't fall for the myth that relations between Muslim Jews were always antagonistic and violent. So when you hear politicians, when you hear neighbors talking about that, this book will provide knowledge that, well, actually, no, it's a much wider spectrum of relations than simply violence or utopian visions.
It's more complicated than that. Always the message of history, I think.
Always.
Always. Well, thank you, Mark David Baer. Mark's book, Children of Abraham, The Story of Jewish-Muslim Relations, is available. It's published by Profile, and it's highly recommended, very pertinent, and has great resonance there. So thank you, Professor Baer.
Thank you for the conversation. Much. Appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to the EI podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please sign up to our mailing list and download the Engelsberg Ideas app. Explore intelligent perspectives on history, culture, and geopolitics anytime, anywhere. And best of all, it's totally free. Until next time, thank you for listening.